This weekend, only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 125, The Manila Galleons, Part 1. Today we're going to look at a subject which had enormous importance for Latin America, Europe, and Asia, but one which is often overlooked. How Spain's New World colonies became linked to its territory in Asia, as well as the powers on the other side of the Pacific. Although this is not one of the first things which comes to mind when thinking about Latin American history, it really did help shape the region and the rest of the world in all sorts of surprising ways. It played a huge part in the emergence of our globalized world, and it helped to fund Spain and its empire. Its importance was such to the people of Mexico that the Inquisition was kept busy investigating people who claimed to use supernatural knowledge to predict when the ships would arrive in Mexico, and those who felt anxious enough about this to use their services. The loss of a single ship could bankrupt people, and while this is often forgotten, the trade even changed the very ethnic composition of some of those people. Many cultural elements found all over the world, which we take to be indigenous to their place of origin, turn out to have developed as part of the fusion which this global coming together of peoples created. As the name implies, one end of this trade route was Manila, in the Philippines. Knowing that the Spanish conquered the Philippines and added them to their empire is enough to understand these two episodes. The initial conquest of the Philippines, which enabled the Manila galleons, however, is the subject of the Friends of the Podcast special episode which has just been released. It's one of those conquest story episodes, like the ones which have made up much of the podcast so far. So if you want to support the show, get that additional context, as well as get access to a growing back catalogue of special episodes, which include looks at the pirate attacks on the Mexican city of Campeche, the mysterious Bolivian civilization of Tiwanaku, and Butch Cassidy's final years on the run in South America, as well as future monthly episodes. You can sign up for $2 a month. There's a link with information about how to do this in the episode description. This trade has largely been understudied until recently, but historians have started to appreciate its importance. One of the earliest and perhaps the most comprehensive books on this subject was written by William Little Schurz. He opens his book with this quote, and it's hard to think of a better way of introducing the subject. He says, "The first of the galleons crossed the Pacific in 1565. The last one put into port in 1815. When the line began, Philip II was king of all the Spains, and his enemy, Elizabeth Tudor, was queen of England. Hernán Cortés, conqueror of Mexico, had been dead but 18 years. The same year, Pedro Menéndez de Aviles laid the foundations of St. Augustin in Florida. When the line ended, it was already 5 years since Miguel Hidalgo had begun the revolt against Spain, which was to create the Republic of Mexico. The United States was then nearly 40 years a nation, and Andrew Jackson had just won the Battle of New Orleans. Yearly, for the 2.5 centuries that lay between, the galleons made the long and lonely voyage between Manila in the Philippines and Acapulco in Mexico. No other line of ships has ever endured so long. No other regular navigation has been so trying, and as dangerous as this. For in its 250 years, the sea claimed dozens of ships and thousands of men, and many millions in treasure. As the richest ships in all the oceans, they were the most coveted prize of pirates and privateers." Because of its international nature, and as we shall see, it was extremely international, The trade is now of interest to historians and archaeologists from diverse parts of the world, which is good because it provides different perspectives. We talk a lot about the Columbian Exchange and the importance of the connections between Europe and the Americas across the Atlantic. I think that the importance of this Pacific equivalent cannot be overstated, however. It really did influence the course of world history. Spain's interest in Asia, of course, went back to the very beginnings of its empire. It was the Spice Islands which Columbus was looking for when he bumped into the Americas. And just because they had found this new landmass didn't mean that their interest had waned. Balboa reached the Pacific and demonstrated its existence, while Magellan's expedition proved that it was possible to reach Asia from the Americas over this ocean, and to continue onwards to Europe, although he himself died in the Philippines. Very soon after conquering the Aztec, Cortes set about trying to set up a link to the Spice Islands from Mexico, hoping to add those riches and glory to what he had already obtained. This never eventuated. Knowledge of the Pacific and its currents at the time was too weak. It wasn't too long, however, before regular crossings did become more feasible. By the time that attempts were made to establish a foothold in Asia, it was too late. Portugal had already established itself in the Spice Islands and elsewhere. This was a disappointment for Spain. However, they quickly came up with another plan. Having initially focused their efforts on the south of the Philippines, closest to the Spice Islands, they moved north to Manila, much nearer to China. They might not be able to control the spice trade, but commerce with their new neighbours could make them rich as well, they realised. Spices would form a small but important part of these new trade routes, even if they were bought second-hand. So let's have a look at the basics of the trade. As William Little Shirt's quote says, the Manila galleons sailed between Acapulco in Mexico and Manila in the Philippines for several hundred years. We will look at the details of what was being traded and moved in more detail. But at its most basic level, silver mined in Latin America was taken to Asia, and Asian goods were brought back to Mexico. The silver was desired, not by the Filipinos, but mostly by China. Manila became the jumping-off point for a trade network which spanned maritime Asia and involved all sorts of peoples and goods. The trip from Acapulco to Manila was fairly straightforward. It took about 3 months to sail fairly directly across the Pacific. The other direction was more difficult, and discovering a way to travel from Asia to North America hindered the early development of the trade. Because of the reliance on winds and currents, ships making the journey had to head north and sail in an arc, reaching the west coast of what is now the USA, and then continuing down the coast to Acapulco. This leg took 6 months, double the journey in the other direction. A couple of ships set off each year, timing their trips to take advantage of those currents. The Philippines is an island nation. If you look at it on the map, you'll see what I mean. There are hundreds of islands. It only came together as a nation because it was grouped like that by the Spanish. The people there are ethnically and culturally related to the people of today's Indonesia and Malaysia. Indonesia has even more islands. All this means that the people in this region were seafarers by necessity. They knew how to build ships and how to sail them. Of course, they also had local knowledge of the specific sailing conditions of Southeast Asia as well. This, combined with the structure of empire, which usually saw conquered peoples do the work required to maintain that empire, meant that in terms of who was actually doing the sailing, it was mainly Filipinos. They were often pressed into becoming galleon crew members, and although the ships were European in design, they were also usually built in the Philippines by Filipinos. Conditions were difficult. Deaths at sea were not uncommon, as were desertions, as we shall see later. Apparently the average sailor was in his late 20s, but some sailed into their 50s. Orphans were a source of labour on the galleons. These could be from the Philippines, Mexico, or even from Spanish cities like Seville. Criminals were also sometimes ordered to serve time on the ships. Besides those Spanish orphans, most Spaniards aboard were captains and higher level officers. So let's have a closer look at those goods which were being transported. From the Chinese side, it was the silver that they desired. Spanish America had just discovered the most significant deposits probably ever in history. These came from Potosí, in today's Bolivia, but also from Mexico itself. This would never be a bad thing in the eyes of a Spanish king, but it also, fortunately, coincided with the rise of a hungry market for it. By analysing the manifests of the ships, we can estimate that a third of all the silver and gold dug up in the Americas went on the Manila galleons, most of it ending up in China. China was having economic problems during this early period. It had been using paper currency, notes like we use today, but there had been widespread inflation and counterfeiting. Silver, then, which could be minted into coins, was a reliable alternative which the country decided to embrace. Later on, China experienced a population boom, and this generated a second wave of demand for the metal. By examining the inventory of the very first galleon to arrive in Acapulco, we can see that 22,000 pieces of Chinese porcelain arrived there, alongside things like silks, spices, furniture, jewels, and dyewoods. On this first occasion, these were mostly taken overland to Veracruz and shipped on to Spain. That porcelain would prove to be very important. It made its way around the globe during this period. There were two routes for it to find its way out of China. The first was this galleon trade to Mexico, and from there to further afield. The second was around the southern tip of Africa to Europe, brought first by the Portuguese, and later by the Dutch as well. I don't know if this is the case in North America, but in England the word China is still used as a synonym for ceramic plates and bowls, even if these items have not been made in Asia or use Asian designs. I think that this demonstrates how much of an impact this particular good and the style which was imported with the items themselves has had in Europe, and this is largely thanks to the trade which happened in this period. Even in this era of mass-produced products and designs drawn from all over the world, it's still common in England to see white plates with patterns and illustrations painted in a distinctive blue colour. Often these depict bucolic English rural scenes, but this design is originally Chinese. The same is true in the Netherlands, where Delftware, ceramics from the town of Delft, has historically been very famous. Again, these use that same blue colour to depict Dutch scenes, and the style has its origins in China.
The Jeep brand has always stood for American freedom. Now with our Freedom of Choice pricing program, you can choose your offer. Cash incentives or employee pricing for all. Hurry into your local dealer today for details. Jeep, there's only one. Offer valid on select 2024 and 2025 Jeep brand vehicles for non-FCA employees and retirees. $200 admin fee applies. Not all buyers and lessees will qualify. Restrictions apply. Not combinable with other offers. Ends 4/30/2025. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
So goods from Asia, brought out of Asia in large part thanks to the Manila galleons, influenced life across the world. But as it was Mexico where they reached first, and as our interest is primarily in Latin America, we should look closely at its considerable and often overlooked impact there. Chinese goods made an enormous impact on life and culture. In 2018, a conference took place in Xiamen in China, which brought together academics from China, Mexico, the Philippines, Taiwan, the USA, Japan, and Hong Kong. This in itself demonstrates how international the trade was. A paper was subsequently published about it, which is fascinating because it included work done by and insights gained from all of these different places. A group from Mexico contributed their work chronicling examples of porcelain made in China, which had been discovered in their country, and which dated from the colonial period. They found it almost everywhere. There were large amounts in Acapulco and Mexico City, as would probably be expected, as well as in Puebla, another of the most important cities in colonial Mexico. They also found it in Cuernavaca, in Veracruz, again not surprising as this was the main port where it was shipped onward to Spain, in Campeche, Oaxaca, and Sinaloa. It was even found in Santa Fe in New Mexico, and in Antigua, today in Guatemala. By the 1600s, according to them, Mexico was saturated with Asian goods. Schurz, whose quote I gave earlier, says that in 1720, everyone from the Spanish city elites to the indigenous peoples of the small towns dressed in fabrics from the Far East and from India and silks from China. He says that by the middle of the 18th century, whether rich or poor, Native American or peninsular, the population of the viceroyalties of New Spain, New Granada, Peru and beyond went dressed in the cottons and silks of Asia and purchased porcelain at shops in Mexico and in South America. This is further illustrated by the Casta paintings from the period. These were part of the colonial authorities' attempts to define the social hierarchy according to a person's ancestry, and they depicted the different castas according to what the painters and society as a whole thought that each combination of ancestry looked like, and how they dressed. Chinaware is often depicted across the different castas, the main difference being that it is shown as being new and expensive in paintings of the higher castas, but chipped and of lower quality when lower castas are being depicted. Like those British and Dutch artisans, soon people in Mexico were designing their own ceramics, which copied Chinese motifs. Today Puebla is still famous for its tiles, and a large part of this is because artisans were brought over from Spain. Apparently Chinese design also played a role in the development of the city's industry and its fame. Workshops developed in the city, but also elsewhere in Mexico, copied these designs, and as well as making their way across the colony, they were also shipped over to Spain. Puebla's connection to the galleon trade is also found in one of its unique cultural traditions. The China Poblana is a style of dress which is part of the city's heritage. I should point out here that during the colonial era, the word China, meaning Chinese, was used as a blanket term for anyone from Asia. China here, then, refers to this connection, and Poblana refers to the city of Puebla. The style of dress is one worn by women, characterized by flamboyant dresses amongst other items of clothing, particularly silk shawls. It was a source of concern for Puebla's high society during the colonial era. It was seen as risque and possibly transgressive, but it was hugely popular among the general population until the late 1800s, and it's still often seen during festivals there. It is said to have originated with a woman named Catarina de San Juan, who lived in Puebla for most of the 1600s. Not that much is known about her, but as best as we can tell, she was actually from India, and probably captured by Portuguese pirates, before being sold into slavery in Manila and taken to Mexico. She eventually became free, and is seen as a saint by some in Mexico. She is said to have insisted on dressing as she would have done in India, and so this is how the style is said to have developed. Going back to that porcelain, two Mexican researchers who participated in the conference in China also highlighted the development of a style called Majolica. This style was popular in colonial Mexico, and it is truly a global fusion. Spanish culture and design was already a mix of European and Islamic North African influences, thanks to the centuries the two spent occupying the Iberian Peninsula simultaneously. The Majolica style added indigenous design features, as well as those from Asia, to create something drawing from four continents. This style then made its way back to Spain, particularly Majorca, which is where its name comes from, and from there to Italy, where it was modified once again. By the 1800s, an evolved form became popular with the aristocracy all over Europe, being displayed at the Great Exposition in London in 1851, and then mass-produced by a British company. Although the spices, which the Spanish were initially looking for, were overtaken in importance by the porcelain and fabrics, they still made their way over to Mexico and Europe. Cinnamon is an important part of Mexican cooking today, often used to spice chocolate, and this came over from Asia. In the episode we did on Mesoamerican food, we also saw how Filipino alcohol distilling techniques influenced the development of mezcal and tequila. You can even see the impact of the Manila Galleons in language. In Mexico, for example, but not elsewhere, the word palapa is used to refer to those wallless, palm-thatched huts you see lining beaches. I had previously assumed that this must be an indigenous word from an indigenous group found in Mexico, which would explain why it's not used in other parts of Latin America. Apparently not. The word came from the Philippines. So what about the cultural impact which went the other way? Chinese historians have highlighted several examples. Beyond the political and economic effects caused by all that silver, which we will cover one day in another episode. To begin with, many plants and foods which are indigenous to the Americas made their way into Chinese cuisine. These include potato, sweet potato, corn, tomato, peanut, and tobacco. These crops played a major part in creating the population boom I mentioned towards the beginning of this episode, which in turn spurred more demand for silver. While the main galleon trade mostly saw goods going the other way, to the Philippines and then Mexico, the connected trade network, which it helped to create in Asia, saw new goods reach China. We will come back to this network later on, but it wasn't just Chinese goods which were being taken across the Pacific. Things would come from elsewhere, stopping in China, before being shipped to the Philippines to be loaded onto the galleons, or reaching Manila first, and then being bought by Chinese traders. A tax record from the coastal town of Huigang lists peacock feathers from India and ivory, presumably either from India or even Africa, as imported goods from Manila eligible for taxation. The trade also impacted warfare. Gunpowder had been invented in China, but once it spread around the world and reached Europe, its use was honed and refined. The Europeans spent a lot of time inventing guns and cannons, which gave them an advantage when fighting each other and other peoples. These became highly sought after in China, and efforts were made to replicate them. This helped change warfare not just in China, but in surrounding countries as well. Of course, being the meeting point between the two trading partners and part of the Spanish Empire, the Philippines was also influenced by the Manila Galleons. They were perhaps the remotest colony of the empire, as viewed from Spain. An administration of them was actually given to Mexico. They were part of New Spain then, not a separate colony. This meant that some historians say that they were not Hispanicized, as Mexico had been, but Mexicanized. That is to say that the task of making them Hispanic fell to Mexico. But as Mexico was itself only partly Hispanic, a culture which they imposed on the Philippines was itself at least partially different to that of the motherland. Those Spaniards that did go there were usually high-level administrators, so their influence was confined to small circles, disconnected from the general population. People from Mexico, however, could be found in every social class, so their culture had more influence. Some of these were missionaries, sent from Mexico rather than Spain, and there are features of the Catholicism found in the Philippines which resemble Latin American religious traditions. One example which springs to my mind are the Easter celebrations, although I haven't seen any work which explicitly makes this link. I have seen videos and photos of dramatic reenactments of the crucifixion in the Philippines, with people dressed as Jesus and Romans. In the most extreme examples, people are actually nailed to crosses. I have not heard of things going quite that far in Latin America, but I have seen similar reenactments. Last Easter, for example, I was in Ecuador, and the whole town came out to watch, as three people were temporarily tied to crosses in the square, while the relevant Bible verses were read out, and men dressed as Romans looked on. On the subject of religion, in the town of Cavite, near Manila, a Guadalupe-style iteration of the Virgin Mary developed in the 1600s, named Our Lady of Porta Vaga, and she was the patron of the Manila galleons. People there still celebrate her every year with feasting, and thank her for protection of the sailors. One final way in which Mexican culture reached the Philippines comes in language. I don't have any examples, but apparently a few Nahuatl words, that is, the language of the Aztec, are used in the Philippines today, alongside Spanish ones. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to do something to support the show, one thing which is extremely helpful is leaving a review wherever you get your podcast from. A huge thank you to everyone who's done this already, and thank you to everyone for listening.
Ram trucks have always powered American freedom. Now with our Freedom of Choice pricing program, you can choose your offer, cash incentives, or employee pricing for all. Hurry into your local dealer today for details, because nothing stops America and nothing stops Ram. Offer valid on select 2024 and 2025 Rams for non-FCA employees and retirees. $200 admin fee applies. Not all buyers and lessees will qualify. Restrictions apply. Not combinable with other offers. Ends 4/30/25. Ram is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.